if your talented, very capable employees don't feel good about working in that operation, yeah, they're going to go elsewhere eventually. They're going to go somewhere else. So they have to, the environment has to be where they're actually motivated to come to work and produce. And it's the structure is the key to that, having the right managers, the right people, or the seats in the bus. And if you don't have it, those folks will eventually leave.
How you doing, Joe?
Great. How are you, Chris?
Thanks for coming down all the way from San Clemente, right?
Carlsbad.
Carlsbad. Why did I get that confused? How long have you been there?
18 years.
That's right. 18. GMI was in San Diego, right?
Yes.
That's what the problem is. And you work for GMI. I got to ask you, I saw some pictures of you recently.
Oh.
And you were a DI in the military. I saw that. And you look like one. Now I go, that I could, let me ask you. Were you a mean DI? What was your game as a DI for the Marine Corps? In fact, how long were you in the Marine Corps?
I went into the Marine Corps right out of high school back in 1984. And I spent 20 years in the Marine Corps and went to Iraq in my last year on active duty and came back from Iraq. I retired at my October of 2004.
So in the Marine Corps, when did you become a DI? Or when did you decide to become a DI? Or is that, are you hand selected? Or you do you apply for it? How does that work?
In the early 90s. You get about 8 to 9 years in your military career, and you have to do what's known as a B billet. So you either got to go as a drill instructor or recruiting duty or embassy duty. And in order to get to that next level, staff and CO level in the Marine Corps. And so I actually did two of them. I did the drill instructor duty for 2.5 years, and I went to embassy duty a couple of years after that and served overseas in two different embassies, one in West Africa and the other one in Switzerland.
Before I get to the drill, because that really interests me, what's the embassy duty like?
It was the detachment commander, and I reported to regional security officer and spent a lot of time with both ambassadors in both Senegal and Bern, Switzerland. And I just had a great time. I took my wife with me and both posts, and we got to tour Europe and went back to the schoolhouse in Virginia and taught there for a year and a half, and then went over to the officer candidate school and trained officer candidates for a year. Right before 9/11 took place. And at that point, I was transferred to the 1st Marine Division at Camp Pendleton and prepared to go to OIF-1 in March of 2003 when we invaded Iraq.
How was that? Were you thinking?
It was an experience. I've never been to combat, so my only combat experience was my last 7-8 months in the Marine Corps. And it was actually, it was a neat experience initially. We had a period for about 3 days where it was a haboob, they call it. It was basically a sandstorm that basically shut everything down for about 3 days. And we couldn't see 6 feet in front of us. And that was the entire everything, the Army, the Marine Corps. We literally just stayed in place for about 2 to 3 days, and the Iraqis couldn't fight. But for the most part, the initial invasion, there was very little resistance. Some of the more disciplined soldiers were willing to fight, and some of our forward units took a lot of combat action. But for the most part, it took about a week and a half to 2 weeks once that storm was over. Within a month and a half, or not a month and a half, but a week and a half, we were in Baghdad and pretty much running the entire country until the initial civilian authority came over there that was assigned by President Bush to run Iraq as an administrator until the Iraqis could do their elections and figure out what their government was going to look like. And then about 9 months later, that's when the army, the Iraqi army, basically reconsolidated as insurgents and got a hold of a bunch of IEDs and started blowing up a lot of our unarmored vehicles. And that's when we started losing a lot of troops.
So 7 or 8 months over there?
6.5.
6.5? Boy, I bet your wife was like, oh my God, you were almost out, and now you're going to go to war.
Yeah, right? It was a period about a week and a half where I didn't talk to her. I didn't have any access to a satellite phone. And she was a little nervous then because that was at the beginning of the war. But for the most part there, I did my tour with the 1st Combat Engineer Battalion and as a company first sergeant, and didn't lose any Marines. So we had one that had a stepped on a landmine, lost his right leg. Actually, from the knee down, he had to have it amputated. But other than that, the second deployment with that command. I didn't go with them on the second command. I was already retired, but that's where we lost probably 8 or 9 of the combat engineers from the same unit. So it just got, and all the way up till 2007, 2008, as you can tell by watching the news, it took a lot of effort and a lot of strategical planning to figure out where that country was going to go. And we stayed there for 15 years. In Afghanistan, we were there for 20 years. And now we've got a situation where I think we're moving forward as a country and fighting either proxy wars or fighting wars like attrition are not going to happen here, at least during this administration's term.
Yeah. What do you think about the Ukraine stuff, being a military guy?
I think we're going in the right direction. I'm totally on board with where President Trump is looking to solve this as quick as possible. And I think it's a good idea to bring Russia into the G8. And I think we should have also diplomatic relations with China as well and have good relations with both countries. So, I mean, it's ridiculous to think that we're in a unipolar world because we're not. It's multipolar at this point. We got to learn how to survive and be civil to each other. So instead of fighting these crazy proxy wars, whether it's in Eastern Europe or in the Middle East, I think we don't have the treasure to keep funding it. And eventually, if it gets out of control, we're going to be drafting hundreds of thousands of troops to go over there and finish the war off. And I think we need to do that through negotiation and peace talks and move on.
Yeah, I agree 100%. It's going to be a big loss, and it's not something that's going to end quickly. That'd be a very long term. They're both very powerful, no question. So now, Marine Corps 2, let's talk about security. How'd you get into security? What was your next step after
the Marine Corps? Well, I initially went into management consulting. I sold management consulting. I got my college degree right before I retired from the Marine Corps and applied to be a consultant, and then they gave me an aptitude test and said, well, you'd be great at selling these services. And I'm like, I'd rather work as a consultant first before I start selling the services. But after about 3 or 4 months, I actually got pretty good at it. And within my first full year with this company, which was a national management consulting company, we're doing about $250 million in recurring revenue. Not recurring, but basically $250 million a year in consulting contracts. And I became their top salesperson in the entire country, talking about 140 different salespeople. And top cash collector, the most valuable player, that kind of thing.
And what were you selling again?
Management consulting services.
Services.
Any company that you go into, I've sold hundreds and hundreds of consulting projects. Just 90% of them have the same problems. The biggest problem they have is they don't have proper organizational structure and culture. And trying to create culture change, it takes an outsider that knows what he's doing to come in and fix those problems for business owners. And then the second biggest problem is financial management. So they don't have the skills in either the wife is running the finances or the owner that started the company. It's now doing $10, $15 million, and he's still the CFO, the CEO, and the COO. He's running 3 different billets. It's hard to scale a company when you don't have either effective partnering or you don't have the proper organizational structure. So just having a conversation with business owners about that was able to get them to move forward to get some professional help to fix those problems with their company. And I traveled all over the United States doing that.
So what makes them move? Because I can't even tell you. I can tell you 5 people right now that are in that position. So what, and it's fear, right? Is it fear? What do you find out the problem is when you go in, you got somebody who's running a $10 or $50 million company and they're still doing that? What's the reason behind it? Is it fear of somebody coming in, taking over? Is it is it a control issue? What is it in your experience?
As far as the impetus to move forward, mm-hmm. change, to make the change, they don't get any sleep. A lot of them struggle with making payroll every payday, and they're not having fun anymore. When they initially started their company, they thought it was great. And your first 1 or 2 or 3 million, that's just rolling up your sleeves, and you can do just about everything yourself and make that happen. But once you get to a $4 or $5 million revenue point, you're going to have a professional structure in place. And so I've dealt with companies that were $15, $20 million, and they were still running it like a mom-and-pop company. And it's like, I got this book over there, Scale or Fail. And that should be, everybody should, if you're an owner of a company, you should have that mindset. If you're not going to scale the company and you get to a certain point, you might as well sell it if you have no desire to want to grow it and grow it profitably.
Yeah, but some people don't know how to get out of their own way.
It's exactly.
Control. It takes a lot to be humble. And with SoberTrack, I wasn't the most, I tell people all the time, I wasn't a strong businessman, but I was good at finding the people I felt that were good players. And then that's when the culture comes in.
Yep.
I'd love to hear your definition of culture, because I think that's an abused word.
Yeah, if you're talented, very capable employees don't feel good about working in that operation, they're going to go elsewhere eventually. They're going to go somewhere else. So they have to. The environment has to be where they're actually motivated to come to work and produce. And it's the structure is the key to that, having the right managers, the right people, or the seats in the bus. And if you don't have it, those folks will eventually leave.
Do you think a company that is 10, let's just say, let's go back, let's take a $5 million, $5 to $7 million company. Do you think a company that size, that's up and down, can they change? The ability to change? Do you think it's too late because of their reputation, their name, the way they treated people in the past? How does somebody like that recover? Do you think they have to do, in other words, do you think they have to almost do a complete shutdown and rebrand themselves to start over? Is it possible?
Absolutely. Put a Band-Aid? Yeah, I've dealt with a couple different companies that had to rebrand because they've made some mistakes. A good example, I didn't work with them or do anything for projects or anything, but the company called Arthur Andersen, which is now Accenture. And they're a respectable national, actually they're a global consulting company right now, Accenture. And it's a great company, but Arthur Andersen was selling management consulting services, and some of their top people out in the field were incentivized to quote-unquote cook the books.
Yeah.
So one of the key things that a lot of folks do in that industry is they recast the financials for businesses. People still do it. Accountants do it. They recast the financials to make the company look more valuable with their valuation prior to going into an acquisition mode. And they got caught doing that, and you know, guess who they were working with? Enron. And you saw what happened with Enron.
But yeah.
That's what took Arthur Andersen down. So that was in the early 2000s. And then they had to rebrand themselves with another name. And I've seen the consulting company that I worked with had to do the same thing. And they're still thriving and probably doing $500 million now from what I just as of last year. And some people were doing some of the same kind of things that, you know, that Arthur Andersen were doing. And it's just human nature. When you let people run and do their magic, sometimes they need those guardrails to make sure that they're doing things correctly.
Well, that's for sure. It's interesting. I think like some of the VC firms, do you think they consult outside? Or do you think they do it within? In other words, having a consulting management company come in and making sure you're doing the right things with the investors' money when you're buying businesses. Because I see a lot of CEOs change hands, right? And they throw it on that guy. It's his fault, his blame. And pretty soon the business is on fire, right?
Tony, talking about valuations, and on the security side, I transitioned from management consulting in the middle of the Great Recession, because the majority of our consulting clients and the management consulting were contractors, so construction-related companies. And that industry was decimated from 2008 all the way up to probably 2011. So in the middle of 2010, I started working for Guardsmark, which was a large national, was the largest private company in the United States in the security industry up until Universal Protection Service acquired them. But it's a unique thing. Allied's been acquiring just about every company that's willing to sell, whether they're a small company like GMI, which is a regional company. They don't really like to buy the real small companies, $5 million and below, but they're looking for those $25 to $100 million companies, someone like SunStates. And they, for the most part, I thought Guardsmark would never sell to them. You know, I mean, I joined the company and asked the owner, I said, you got four sons and they're all younger than me. This company's got a good succession plan in place. I'm good to go. I don't have to worry about them being acquired. And the owner was 70 years old, and I don't think he had confidence that his kids really had their heart into it like he did to take it to the next level, which would have been $1 billion because they were already at $500,000. And they were in every city in the United States. We had branches all over the country. And I was shocked when they sold to him. And that owner actually, within 18 months or 2 years later after he sold the company to Allied, he passed away of a massive heart attack in 2019.
Wow. Do you think he was just saying, you know what? I don't trust my kids, but I need to take care of them, so I'm going to close this deal down and
please
get some money.
All his kids were extremely talented. I'm still friends with a couple of them.
Okay.
And we talk on social media, sometimes on the phone. They're all doing successful. They're in different businesses now. And the oldest son is on a couple boards. He's invested in a couple startup companies. He's actually one of the founders of Circadian Risk, which is the risk management company that I work with.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about them. Can you?
Sure.
Okay, tell me about them.
Yeah, we do. The banking, there are certain industries that are regulated by the government where they have to have risk assessments done on a regular basis. And the banking industry and the healthcare industry are two of the largest industries. Wells Fargo is one of our clients, so we're doing those assessments for about 5,000 Wells Fargo branches across the country. So I probably spend 80% of my time when I'm working with them just calling on banks. Mission Federal Credit Union, which has about 30 branches down in Southern California, and a couple others. And most of the leads that I'm getting from the company to call on are either healthcare chains or banking institutions. But they're required to do it. We've got a proprietary software that we built, and one of the co-founders is the CIO of the company. He's brilliant. All of us worked for Guardsmark. So, the managing partner, not the managing partner, but the chairman of the board who provided the capital to get the company started was the oldest son of Ira Lippman, who was the founder of Guardsmark. And our guy that did old school assessments for Guardsmark came to work for us as an intern from Michigan State back in the late 90s. And he spent 10, 15 years just doing old school risk assessments, killing trees every time he did an assessment because he had 300-400 pages of paper. And he had a degree in computer science, and he figured out there's got to be an easier way to do this. And after Guardsmark was acquired, he brought the idea over to Gus Lippman, who was the oldest son, and sold him on the idea of creating a company for that. And it's doing very well. They're doing great.
That's terrific.
Yeah.
So let's go back to GMI. Let's go for stepping back a little bit. Tell me about GMI. How'd you get involved?
Yeah, so after Guardsmark was acquired, GMI was the company that they recruited me, basically put the little open for work thing on my LinkedIn, and Ben Cordova, who was the president of GMI, I interviewed with him and was working for him 4 or 5 days later. And GMI was probably my best experience in working out of the 3 or 4 companies that I've worked for in the security industry. Larry Abrams understood what it took to get a company to be able to, he had it set up to where it could run without him.
Yeah.
He was running his own client point, which was paperless proposal back then. And his two best operators were running the company for him and doing a great job. And he had a CFO that was extremely competent. So he had a great CFO, he had a great director of operations, a COO, and then Ben was the president. And I was running sales on the security side, and we had a guy by the name of Paul Greenland who was running, he was overseeing both because he was also doing marketing. And at the end of the day, his job, he came in to prepare the company to be acquired.
Really? So,
I didn't know that when he came in, but we became great friends. We're still good friends. But that was a great experience. I was there for almost 4 years, and we grew the company up to about $50 million, and both janitorial and security services.
What'd they start with when you came in?
Just a janitorial company initially back in the 70s and 80s, and then Lawrence graduated from college and eventually took over the business from his dad and turned it in from a mom-and-pop company into a $50 million integrated services company, both janitorial, security. We did a little bit of construction services as well.
Yeah.
And I just had a little great operation. It was a lean and mean company. They knew what they were doing. And we had a couple of hiccups operationally when I first got there, and we fixed those and brought in a real good director of operations, and we were able to start selling again and killed it for about the 2 years leading up to the acquisition. And we sold the company, or they sold the company right in the middle of COVID. At that point, that's when I ended up with a private company down in San Diego, Iron Wall Security.
Yeah,
Matt's also worked for him.
Yeah, that's right. And it's funny, Lawrence has really done a good job. I was side by side with him down there in San Diego when he was doing the maintenance part of the division in the very beginning down there with Stuart Posnock, because I had the Garden Communities contract, and that's where Silvertrack was put together. So I built Silvertrack. I did it with Stuart down there, parking, security, maintenance. I had the concept, but I really put it in play down in his neck of the woods in San Diego and La Jolla area, and we really proved that model out, and it was a big success for me. And then Client Point came in, so I was at the trade shows, right? Because when I sold my security company with Silvertrack, I originated the real-time reporting, went out to the security market. This is before Apple or Android, and then Lawrence came out with Client Point. So we were, again, side-by-side at the trade shows for quite some time, and then GMI rolls out, and they bought Silvertrack, and then you've had quite a bit of experience with Silvertrack and real-time reporting. I think you guys did roll well with that, like a lot of people in the beginning with the reporting tool too. And you, so you started, so they grew really fast is where you're going, starting with the maintenance division, and then they rolled the security versus doing security, and then a lot of people getting into maintenance, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, we didn't use Silvertrack for our janitorial and maintenance side. We should have, because I think we could have easily, like you're doing with Vision, it can be utilized in different verticals, not just security.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just getting back to Lawrence real quick, he understood the importance of, you got to have, if you want to scale a company, you got to have working capital to start, especially a large RFP, you know, it takes 4 to 6 weeks of working capital that you got to have, you know, on your balance sheet to be able to fund it. And if you're operating your company paycheck to paycheck, payroll week to payroll week, it's going to be a struggle just to start a new business.
Most security companies should always have about 6 to 7 months worth of payroll in their bank, period, and then they pick up a big RFP and they risk it.
Absolutely, and a line of credit as well, especially. Yeah. I know GMI had a $4 million line of credit, and they tapped into it multiple times every year, not just for payroll, but to have the capital to start $1 million, $2 million projects.
So let me ask you, how does a security company go get a line of credit, especially small to mid-level, when maybe their credit isn't the best themselves and their business is still, what, 2 or 3 years, maybe 4 years? How many years do you have being in business? What kind of background, or I should say, what kind of financials do you have to go out and reach to go to a bank to be able to get that kind of line of credit?
If you've got a healthy balance of receivables, a bank will give you, your interest rate will probably be higher if you don't have a good credit score. But you can factor those receivables to get a line of credit. Any business can. We used to help back when I was doing helping contractors out in the management consulting days. The consultants would come in and help them factor their receivables to get capital to do more projects on the consulting side. So we'd figure out how to fund the consulting project. In the case of the services industry with security or janitorial, if you're running a business for 4 or 5 or 6 years, you got to have a stable financial situation in order to keep that company going. And I have run into business owners that they don't have good credit because they're overextended. But again, you can always factor the receivables to get that money.
A lot of people get scared about that. The ones I talk to, they're so scared. No, my client doesn't want to do that because they want to deal through me. I don't want the company to invoice them and pay them, and I don't want to get in. There was a lot of fear in doing that. And the audience that I have today is small to mid-level. I imagine there'd be a few people that are 5 or 10 million, but 80% of the market, small to mid-level, that's where it's at, probably a little bit higher. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is what's so great for you to share, is that's what they really have to do if they want to grow. And they don't know. They don't. They think they're going to do it through contracts. And the big part is getting a good contract. Then they say, hey, I want to go get hospital contracts. I want to go get school contracts or government contracts. They have to have history. They got to have that, because you got to tell them, Joel, when you're going in for an RFP, if you can, tell them what these clients are looking at. When you're submitting your application, it's not just that you've been in business 3 or 4 years. They're looking at your financials. They're looking at a lot of different things. History, like you said, line of credit. What things have you...
Yeah, on a large RFP, GMI, we did a bid for Qualcomm. It was just literally 3 months before we were acquired by the company that was the incumbent for Qualcomm. So it was literally within a couple of weeks after that bid was over, when they basically decided to stay with Allied Universal, it was announced that they were acquiring us within a couple of days after that. But anyway, we had to prove that we had enough working capital, i.e. a line of credit, and $4 million is definitely enough to get that started. And then we had to partner with another company to help with the cleared work if we got the contract, because we didn't have a cleared piece of our business. So we used one of the NSA partners to do it.
That's the National Security Alliance, right?
National Security Alliance.
That's, what, four or five companies? Or actually 10? How many?
There was about 14 companies.
Was it 14?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I think you had 12 of those 14 using your software.
Yeah, I remember going to Texas, and I remember going to, I think it was Austin, then I remember going to Vegas when Kim Anderson had her office up there in Las Vegas. She's in Phoenix, too.
Yeah, I've been to three of those. Well, actually four. Chicago, San Diego, Vegas, and Phoenix, Arizona.
So what makes a good security company? I know we're going to go back to
my best experience was with GMI. GMI, if they wanted to stay in business, could have been a $100, $200 million company if they really wanted to. And obviously, we'd have to, as you grow a company and you get new contracts, you can hire more operators and more managers. And as long as they're well-trained, you can open up more branches. I'll give you a little story about Ira Littman. When he started, he was in his, like, 21 years old when he started Guardsmark back in the 60s. And in the mid to late 70s, he realized he wanted to become a national company, but he didn't have the capital to go national, to start branches all over the country. And he took the company public. He took the company public, and that's how he got his working capital to. And then once he got his structure is in place that he wanted and had it rolling to where he could sustain being a national company, he took the company private again.
Man, I just want to know how many marriages that cost him and how many bad partnerships.
He only had one.
Really?
Only one.
Smart guy.
Yeah. But he surrounded himself with great people, and the guy had an unbelievable talent. We had probably about 40 former FBI agents that were retired FBI agents working for GMI. 10 or 15 of them working in sales. One guy that I replaced was a former FBI guy. And we had a lot of retired military working there as well. But the management there was half of SunState right now is former Guardsmark managers.
Yeah.
That's why they're such a great company.
Yeah, SunStates. Yeah, I talk about them all the time.
They're the gold standard right now.
They really are. I'm from Glenn Burrell all the way down. Glenn sold recently.
Yeah, and then Dennis now is running the company.
Dennis is Dennis a great Kelly. Guy. Yeah. I love Dennis. But gosh, man, I miss him, though. So I hope nothing changes. I'm sure it won't. The culture's there. That's for sure. And I don't care if you're talking to a guard, like I said, to an executive. They all walk and talk the same. And that's culture to me. I was always very impressed. They always were very nice to me when we had SilverTrack. Very nice to my team. Very professional. Nothing was over the top. It was always very reasonable when they have a problem. So we tried to do the same thing with SilverTrack. Again, this is all pre-2019, but I really enjoyed them as a client. And the good part is I think we're coming back with vision.
I think they're the perfect example on what it takes to scale a company the right way, just like Guardsmark did back in the day and Allied Barton, when it was just Allied Barton. Obviously, the AUS way is just do it mainly through acquisitions, which I don't think is the smartest business model because it's not doing the right thing by the clients. I've just seen it from working for three other companies, two of which have been acquired by Allied. What is they lose half those clients within 6 to 8 months.
Yeah, I hate to badmouth anybody, but the idea is they do $1 million presentation, but they're not doing anything different than a small to mid level. To me personally, I have never really heard anything super great about them. They're obviously they've got the backing, they've got some good managers, but I just hear how those people get burned out. They work them to death.
Yeah, just to show you the ratio, the comparison between someone like Windshield, he's got his account managers are managing 1,500 to at the most 2,000 hours, and an AUS account manager is managing 8,000 to 15,000 hours.
Yeah.
Some of the ones that are handling big contracts are doing like 15,000 hours, and then the other ones that are doing a bunch of little sites are probably doing 8,000 hours, so that's why they get burned out.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, if you're not taking care of these people and you got a revolving door in some of these key positions, you're going to lose clients. You're going to lose these recur contracts. And if you're not scaling, you're not selling, you're going backwards.
The small to mid-level can't afford a sales person. Even if they attempt it, they're still not aligned. They don't have a good management team, a good operations team. They don't have a they don't have an operations plan on how to even retain the client, in addition to learn how to partner with them and do and provide a better service.
Chris, a good business owner is his best salesperson when you start that company. And you know, look at Matt.
You know,
he's one single-handedly has grown that thing to $8 to $10 million and without having a sales guy.
Matt Rash is very unique. Okay. I'm telling you now, I saw him back when he came into a meeting, you know, with Brian Cohen, actually. We were doing a presentation and I was up there and I was talking, and I picked him out of probably 30 people around the table. And he'll tell you to this day, I grabbed him and I said, hey, you and I need to stay involved here because I saw his potential. And like he's what, 10 to 15 now? Mil?
He's just shy of 10 million.
Okay, 10 mil. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I love Matt. He does a really good job, and I know you know him well, too. Let me ask you, what makes a good... You are probably the most humble person, calm, and I know you do an unbelievable job for sales, and the company has to back up obviously, when you go out and sell the service, the company has to back it up, and that's a problem with a lot of the companies today, and why they can't even retain somebody, either upper scale, because the sales guy will go out and do the sale, but then they lose a contract within 3 months because the company can't perform. So these guys always wonder, how come my sale guy is stealing all my stuff and he's not selling the business for me? It's because they can't keep it. So what was your, I know GMI operationally was strong, but what made you a good sales guy?
I learned some good skills in the management consulting days. I did it for 6 years where the questions are the answer. If you just ask the right questions, you'll figure out where the pain is, why they're not happy with the incumbent. And then if you talk to these clients long enough, they'll ask you, basically, please get me a proposal. And as long as your numbers aren't, you know, too far off from what we're currently paying, we'll give you the contract. I did a lot of sole source bids over the years where it wasn't even competitive. Coronado Shores is a perfect example. I sold that twice.
Really?
To two different companies. And both of those were sole source. And these are deals that had to go in front of HOA boards, and that's a large HOA board. It's 10 huge towers there, and it's almost $1 million contract. And Allied was the incumbent on the last one, and then Bald Eagle was the one before that. So when I sold it for GMI, Bald Eagle was the incumbent, and then Allied with Iron Wall.
Oh. What tools? What outside of sales, culture? What were some of the tools you guys used? I'm not trying to get into the real-time reporting side, but let's get into the real-time reporting.
Well, the paperless proposal system was extremely beneficial. The productivity for sales is quadruple compared to not having that. If you're doing proposals old school, like how Matt does it, he's got like a 4 or 5 page proposal that just basically has a little bit of information about their company background and the pricing page, and that's really it. On that paperless proposal system, you're able to put together some very customized, impressive proposals with 20, 30 pages of real good content. And it converts it all into one PDF, and then you send it to them as a link where you can track the analytics and when they're opening the proposal and what page they're going to and how much time they're spending on the proposal. And 90% of the clients go right to the pricing page.
Sure.
So they skip all the all the fluff. But you still got to have the stuff to back it up. They'll go to the pricing, and then they go through the other stuff a little quicker. But they remember, if you got impressive proposals, that it's going to stand out.
Yeah, that's the way people have to look at it, too. Maybe they go to the back page. It's an excuse to say, I don't want to spend the money for it. Okay, and then the other problem is they don't want to put the time in designing the proposal correctly. Everybody thinks it's a 3 or 4 page because that's what they've been selling. But how do you step it up? Clients see it's a flashy car, right? You got to have that. But again, you got to be able to back it up. And it's no different than Silvertrack. I developed Silvertrack. Abrams developed paperless proposal, which is Client Point. Now it's Client Point. Of course, he knows how to drive that thing. And I knew how to drive Silvertrack. And it was huge. That's what I did with my security company. And trying to share that with people sometimes, it's just so difficult. So difficult.
Well, the data, having those analytics in real time, I can't tell you how many proposals I've sent out over that 4 years with GMI, where I'd send them a link through paperless proposal to their email like a year before that, and they weren't ready to make a change at the time. I just gave him a proposal because they said, yeah, give me a proposal and I'll keep it on file. And when the time comes, I'll let you know. And a year later, they're going back to their email and finding my link. And we have we deactivate the link after 90 days. But the customer will get a response from the paperless proposal server that basically tells them this link is no longer active. We'll let, you know, the owner of this link know that you're interested in getting a new one. And so I would get a notice from paperless proposal that, you know, so-and-so tried to open this proposal dated 9 or 10 months prior. And I'd call them up 5 minutes later and they're like, yeah, let's set up a meeting because I think we're ready to make a change now. But if we didn't have that system, they wouldn't be on their radar screen.
Yeah.
Totally makes a difference. I probably got 15, 20 sales just from that alone, having that mechanism. And again, just being able to track that and see, you could manage 30, 40 proposals over the course of a couple months. I was only managing probably 15 to 20 at my most productive times. Whereas if you're doing things old school, 5 to 6 is about all you can really manage at one time.
Yeah, you have to put it all together. It takes days to do it. It's a waste of time when you got it all dialed in already and you just plug in the information pretty much. Outside of some of the changes that you need to customize.
Yeah, and every week we would do a sales meeting, you know, along with operations, and we would pull up all the data in paperless proposal and go through what's the status of this proposal. It's a month and a half old or whatever. And we'd go through each one of them and talk about them. And that tied into the operational stuff as well. And that's what ClientPoint is now. Now it's more than just a sales tool. It's a true CRM for every department in the company. And so Lawrence has got that now to the point where you can client points for any industry. So it's way beyond the security vertical.
How are they doing?
They're doing well. Mm-hmm. They're doing well. It's like I said, it's a paperless proposal Securitas was the largest customer, probably still is.
Yeah.
And I had many clients tell me that, you know, hey, your proposal looks a lot like Securitas, but they were also the two best according to the client's response. But on the system, I think it's too watered down right now to the point where, you know, you're claiming that you can do everything. And I don't think anybody that's trying to sell SaaS, that's trying to do all these different things, and it's just for your other reporting software companies that are trying to do HR and scheduling and everything else that's
all
tied into it,
solution.
They're not going to be good at it. And no. That's where ClientPoint's at right now. So they're at that point where I think they're trying to get that to where they can get it all. I think if there's riches in the niches, right? So you focus on the one thing that you're real, real good at and you just drive that thing. And that's what paperless proposal was. I loved it.
Yeah, very simple. So, you're right. Yeah. And it's what we're doing today with Vision. We said if we were going to put something together, if I was going to jump back into the game, there's a lot of different things, and AI opened that door to do. And I said, if I'm not going to go out and develop a similar solution to SilverTrack to try to save the day or get into scheduling payroll that I don't know anything about, I'm dealing with a small to mid-level market that nobody has interest in. You got people writing code on napkins back in the day, and they have no industry experience. They're just thinking, oh, payroll scheduling, this is what they need. But they can't even support their original tool, which was a real-time reporting. Mm-hmm. Just that alone. Pick up the phone, support it, talk to them, share your experience. They didn't have that background. Then they get scheduling involved, then they get the payroll thing. And it's an 8 to 12-month deal even to get it organized. And then they have the meetings with the companies and the setup meetings. And those take forever because somebody misses a meeting. Now, we're going to move it on to next week. Meanwhile, the owner's paying all this money for this program to get it up and running, it delays.
Yeah, so the gentleman that I did a webinar with you, he was an owner of a security company out of Chicago. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I do. He was doing the high-rises, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So he's using a company that I just mentioned. He's trying to do everything, and he's the only one that can do it. He doesn't have any. There's no one else that's trained to do it. So he's totally spends 6 to 7 of his 8 hours a day just managing that,
yeah,
and working every aspect of trying to get it right, and it's that's not what those tools are designed for. It should make your life easier, not more complex.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. being a former Silver Trek, let's get into it. I'm going to go ahead and promote Vision real quick. What do you think? What do you like about the difference? What do you see? Now, I know I don't know how much I've shown you a Vision, but from what you've seen, what do you like about it? What do you see?
I would say Silver Trek's 2.0, but it's way beyond that. I think you're especially with the advent of AI, there's no one else in the industry that's got to that level yet. And the industry hasn't even seen your product yet, for the most part.
No, they haven't. I had to wait. Had to wait for the non-compete. Yeah. But the good part about it is that 26, 28 years in the industry, all boxed up, using AI with every vertical, sharing that, connected to that.
What you've done, Chris, is what I talked about initially when we started talking about what's important with why businesses are successful. You have effective partnering, which is probably the most important strategy in running a business. If you have ineffective partnering, you're gonna fail. But anyway, you have effective partnering, and those partners are extremely talented, and you guys complement each other. You're not trying to step on each other's feet, and those guys are great. They're very talented, and you got some great salespeople as well. So you're set up for success, and you killed it with Silver Trek, and I think you're gonna blow it out of the park with Vision. I just think you're off to something that's going to be special, and I think the industry is going to reward you because there's no other product in the marketplace that actually competes.
Yeah, and I got to give a shout out. I appreciate you saying that, but it's friends like you that I've known for many years and clients that I've known for many years that just doubles that factor for the fact that I have relationships too. Or I like to think that it was trustworthy and helpful at the time because my team had industry experience. We were there, we were helpful, and they remember that. So that's a big help too. Mm-hmm. There's no question that having that trust factor and support, because that's everything. It's got to work, okay? It's got to work. It's got to be very easy, and you have to have support.
Absolutely.
And if you have the experience on top of that and you're willing to pick up the phone and have a conversation with them, especially for me because I understand that owner. Right. In other words, if a security officer on post has an issue, I think like the owner, please, this is a brand new contract. This guy's got to be live. That client's expecting a report the next morning. That's my thought process. Not how can I get this guy off the phone and get him connected to a bot so I don't have this conversation again. Just get him through the phone call so I can document that I help somebody. No, it's not going to work. It's small to mid-level operators or people just like me. I want to share that. It's my last hurrah. So this is what I want to do. So,
well, like Salesforce, I know their data with AI, the results on using AI right now is they call it an AI agent, can handle about 80% of the customer calls, which is great because it makes the customer reps more, can handle real problems instead of just dealing with the minor stuff. You let the AI agents deal with it. And only about 20% you actually need to talk to a human being. I don't know if that's something that would you rather have an AI agent actually answering most of those questions?
No, we're not going to. I've got great partners. I want to bring that in. I have partners, two other partners in this, and my team, I consider them partners as well, okay? But we're not going to do that, and I'm not going to hockey stick this business for a sale. I'm not trying to. I didn't even want to sell Silver Trek. That's a whole nother story someday. I'd love to share the story behind mm-hmm. that. If I could go back, you know what? I don't think I want to go back because AI is advancing so quick. People have no clue what we're going to produce and what we are producing, even with that. I'm so far ahead of the game, not just with the background, the knowledge from parking, security, maintenance, incident, understanding each vertical client. What we're about to offer a small to mid-level company is game-changing. It's retention. It's sales. It's reducing training problems. We are literally taking the guard, the security officer, on the property, and we can literally just put somebody there, and they can open up and go to work. They're trained. They're shown exactly how to do the job they're supposed to do, the pitch they're supposed to take. I don't care if they speak Spanish. I don't care Chinese. You can write it. That's probably a bad thing to say, but write it. It enhances a note, it documents, it keeps it all. And we're looking at the analytics, unbelievable, especially because we're building it out for the client. We're not building it for the guard company. Everybody that sells real-time reporting today, they use it as an accountability tool. And I think you agree with me. That's when you sold real-time reporting, you guys focused on the client needs.
correct? Absolutely. That was probably the one differentiating advantage that we had, because most of the customers that we were competing, or clients that we were trying to sell, we were the only security company that had SilverTrax, and out of the three or four companies that were bidding on the project, and made a huge difference.
So you agree. Yeah. Build it for the client.
Yeah.
That's simple. Build it for the client. But there's so many verticals. People think they understand the client, but they don't. And that's another tool that we offer within the AI.
When GMI was acquired, there was a good percentage of customers that didn't want Allied's software. They demanded that they continue with SilverTrax, and they did.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They did up probably for about 7 or 8 months.
Yeah.
They kept using SilverTrax.
Yeah.
Until you know what happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll tell you,
this is going to be an unbelievable tool, because the other side of it is we're now be able to not just provide it to the guard industry, but I'm going to the vertical client itself. I'm going to the owners of the property. I build it out for them. They come to me for the operator, mm-hmm. because I know quite a few people across North America because of my relationship with SilverTrax and working with other companies, and I can literally feed them contracts and their setup. So if you got your own operation, just ride piggyback with me. You can learn how to build it for yourself, and retention's everything, especially if you want to sell your business. I think it's going to be, it's only begun, it's just begun. And I'll leave it at that. It's going to be very exciting. And we're going to share a lot, too.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah.
I think it's an industry, as far as the technology side of what you've mastered, it's going to take a long time for somebody to duplicate what you've done. I don't think it's going to be knocked off anytime in the next couple of years. I think you're way ahead of everyone else in the market.
Yeah. It's, and the reason for that is, again, it's my 30 years of data to it. Vertical specific, in other words, whether it's multi-housing or commercial, all the language, all the proper terms, the liability, unless you understand it. So in other words, we're not going into AI and say, hey, give me this information. I've dumped it into AI. And then there's all the prompts behind that, works with the information coming in. It's evaluating the true information. And then we're even stepping up further because it gets smarter. So I've dumped in a pretty good brain already. And now it's just building upon that. So it's going to be pretty hard for anybody on the outside, unless you really understand the industry and you've done real-time reporting.
So real quick, I got one question for you, Chris.
Sure.
What was your impetus for creating Vision? What sparked you or gave you the...
I didn't like the way my relationship ended with the company that purchased us. I was very disappointed in the way the customers were treated after we sold, okay? I felt that I was promised things that were never delivered. Okay. It was all about getting the business and growing it, and it's the end game, and they wanted that to be very quick. And with all the relationships I had, it absolutely killed me to have, I call them friends and family, clients of mine, to call me up and say, Chris, what are you doing? Because I was still technically tied to them as a consultant. And Joel, I tried everything. Keeping relationships, working with the clients, but I could not upsell them on a product, even to go to TrackTick, to force them to get them to payroll and schedule just so we could get the numbers when they weren't ready to go. It's a smaller company. They didn't need payroll and scheduling. They were barely using the reporting tool correctly. So if they would have stayed focused and just say, hey, let me help you get there. But they couldn't do that because they didn't have anybody on the phone to even guide them, to give them expertise. Give them an e-book on how to make yourself a better operator so we can implement scheduling. Let's build your company and get 30 people in. Let's try scheduling, and then we'll go to payroll, and then we'll support you. No, don't do this. No, do that. It was just about to sell and close, mm-hmm. and then we weren't even picking up the phone for support, and that's the problem today. I know there's going to be a lot of people who are not going to like to hear this, but that was a big part because I was done. I was just so burnt out and so frustrated. And then my partners and I got together, and they came to me, these people. They had a pretty good idea. I can only talk so much about that, but I'm going to make a comeback.
And again, your partners are folks that believed in you. They believed in your ability to restart the dream and build it even better than what it was before.
Yeah.
And you just, like you said, it's right timing with AI because it's just a whole new – dynamic level that it's going to provide to separate it from everyone else.
Yeah, I was very blessed to have the people, even the people I have now and the people that I still want to involve in this business in addition to my customer base. I'm very passionate about it. Everybody knows that, the way I talk. I'm very passionate about the business. It's caused me, and like other operators that are in industry, security operators, I feel their pain. I know what they're going through. It's cost me marriages. I totally understand the bad partnerships. I know what it's like to own a small security company. So anytime I can be a part of their, anytime I can provide them assistance just in their business alone, outside of real-time reporting, they could call me and say, hey, what car would you buy? Or hey, I'd say, hey, I wouldn't do this because of that. I go, oh my gosh. And their wife would get on the phone and say, Chris, thank you so much because he wanted to buy that Dodge Charger. And I'm telling them we should buy electric, we could save gas and money. These are the conversations we had. So it was well above real-time reporting, but it was just great having great relationships. And unfortunately, that's my family. I don't have a personal big family. I've passed and moved on. I've had bad experiences with. So this is my family, and I want to. The next 10 years, I'm going to come back real strong, and I'm hoping. I want you to be a part of that too. Yeah. You've been a big help as well.
I've seen what you've done with like Matt and even with JD down in San Diego. They kind of look to you as a big brother to get advice from and help them figure out how to deal with some of the challenges that they have as business owners. And you've got a lot of experience to share and help them along the way.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you saying that. And with I call them kids. They're not kids. They're 30 years old. But the people involved in Vision, the people I'm bringing in, I want to leave them something. They do. This isn't just come work as an employee and make Chris rich. That's not it. That's not what I'm... I don't even care about the money. That's a whole nother... I'll have to get into that story about when you get some money. No, it's a compromise, really is. This is peace of mind. This is really a lot of fun.
You've had the big toys, airplanes and big RVs, boats.
Yeah, and it felt good for a little bit.
Yeah.
That's it. You're right. It felt good for a little bit. Very fortunate, but this is where it's at. Helping people feels good, you know, and I really enjoy this business. So we're gonna make a big change, and we've got some unbelievable things coming. I'll tell you, AI is absolutely incredible, scary, incredible. As soon as it starts thinking for itself, we're in trouble, Joel. It starts thinking.
We're almost there.
Yeah. But let me ask you in close, what do you think the idea here, the big logo on the door, the concept to take small and mid-level operators like we talked about, consult, teach, show, bring them into where we can help grow their business? From what little we spent some time with this,
it's kind of like taking the alliance concept and bringing it to 2025, where we've got a whole new aspect of why this type of business is important to the industry, and just like the NSA was, but I think we're leveraging technology and we're providing a service and a software product that no one else has, it's gonna set them up for success.
Yeah.
And that's what it's all about, right? It's to help other business owners get to where they want to go. And they can't do it on their own.
No doubt. They've heard it from one of the best, and we've got more, right?
Yep.
You're my consultant. We're working together on this operation, and we're hoping to share that with all the small to mid-level. Not looking for any big operators if think they got to figure it out. I know there's some bad operators, but I've got a pretty good idea across North America on the ones that worked, which ones are good. I call it my family, and I want to give back. That's what we're going to do. So I'm making the investment to share whatever they need to make them a better operator so they can win. So at the end of the day, it's not a hockey stick business for us to make money. It's really to do something very unique with the industry. Everybody respect us, and I think we'll see that by people that subscribe or go on and look, and we'll get feedback, obviously, and we'll make things better. But it's real truth about the operators and the things that go on, the pain points, the good points, and we'll bring experts in whatever you need. I don't care if it's payroll, scheduling. Come on. Can we figure it out for them? It's right here.
Yeah.
It's right here.
Yeah.
So when you coming back? I want you here again. When are you going to come back? This has been a great interview. Great podcast.
Come back up and within the next week or two.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's get together. I'd like to do these. This has been a terrific lesson for everybody. I think people are going to want to hear and want to see more.
Yeah.
So we'll get Matt down here too. And you, of course, you, I can't even imagine your Rolodex. Maybe you can bring some of those people in too. And we'll just share.
Bring some clients down here.
Yeah.
That's what I'll do. I'll bring a couple people that I think could be on the property management side. You kind of got me going there with the multifamily stuff.
Sure. And then close out for those on the vision side, guys. If you're interested, I'm going to give plug to vision. If you're interested, just DM us. Is that what they call it? Download? DM? Yeah. Is that right? Is that? Am I saying it right there, Steve?
Direct message.
There you go. Direct message. I'm still learning the social media stuff. Okay. So, anyways, thanks for coming.
Hey, thank you. This was fun.
Yeah, sure was.
Enjoyed it.
All right, buddy. We'll talk soon.
Yep. Thanks, Chris.
You bet. Hey, everyone. No matter where you're watching from, if you get anything out of this, please like and subscribe. And most importantly, share this everywhere you possibly can. And if you're feeling extra generous, please leave us a comment. Thank you for watching.